Welcome to the Student Paramedic Podcast. Welcome back to another episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. My name's Alex and I'm your host today. And today we're interviewing Matt Cannon. Now, Matt is the CEO over in Papua New Guinea for the St. John Ambulance Service over there. And he's very kindly taken some time out of his day to have a chat to us to help give you guys the opportunity to hear what it's like to be a paramedic and run services over in another country. So we hope you enjoy. Now, Matt, would you like to give us a little bit of an introduction about yourself?
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show this morning, Alex. I'm the CEO for St. John. As you said, I've been in this role for 4 years. I've been in Papua New Guinea 6 years. I started my career with St. John as a cadet back in 2013. So I think this is my 17th or 18th year, going into my 18th year with St. John Ambulance. For me, joining as a 13-year-old cadet, I had an interest in the area, but had no idea where I wanted to go career-wise at that young age. Later on, I sort of left St. John and I came back when I was a bit older, and it really spurred me on to go to uni. I first studied a Bachelor of Nursing 3/4 of the way in my final year. I got offered a job with New South Wales Ambulance, which was, I thought, it's a very competitive process, and I thought I'd apply once so that I get used to the process, and I was surprised, but also very happy that I got accepted into New South Wales Ambulance, and that was about 10 and a half years ago. So I started on road and also finished my nursing degree. And at the same time, volunteering with St. John gave me really good opportunities to meet people in the industry, to be mentored, to be shown the right way. And I found that the connections I had through St. John were meaningful and helped to progress my interest in the profession, but also helped to create great mentor relationships that later on in New South Wales Ambulance, I found that the St. John relationships were sometimes even more deep than what I had with my full-time colleagues. In 2014, I applied for a secondment from New South Wales Ambulance to the Minister's Office, and I was working in Minister Skinner then, the Health Minister's Office, as the Ambulance Liaison Officer to Parliament and the Minister's Office. And that was a very rewarding job that gave me a great oversight of the bigger picture to what we do as ambulance. I think as paramedics, we can get quite focused on the clinical care and frustrated that management aren't making decisions that we think need to be made. But there's often a huge big picture to the beast that is any big organisation. So I found that rewarding, and certainly spurred my interest to study a Master of Public Health. And I jumped at an opportunity to come to Papua New Guinea back in 2015. When there was a vacancy for a very short-term assistance role. And I did that role for a month and came back to Australia and juggled being on road part-time with studying. And look, 6 years later, I'm here still in PNG and thoroughly enjoying the work, because it's a great balance between the managerial and the administrative tasks that probably many people listening to the podcast aren't too interested in at this point in their career, but a good balance as well with being able to keep my clinical skills current and also work with some great doctors and nurses that have been there throughout the process.
That's really cool. So when you went and did your master's in the public health, has that really helped in your role now to be able to sort of tailor the care and the way that you provide the service over in Papua New Guinea to what they actually need?
That's a great point. I'm a quarter of the way through my Master of Public Health. I've put it on hold the last few years because of various big activities we've had to do here in PNG, and the latest being COVID. The two subjects I have done so far, I think, immensely contributed to being better prepared for this role. I think I did a comparative healthcare systems and also a disaster management a short course over a few months, and so that certainly helped me in the roles that I do here in PNG.
Definitely. And even when I've done a bit of research into it, and you've had a lot of focus on maternity health over there as well. So I was listening to one of your seminars. You said that, is it 1 in 30 women will die at childbirth? And so trying to implement systems and approaches to that, that can help in their sense, because that doesn't happen over here. So having to change that, I guess, that care requirement to them is really cool, I guess, that you're able to do that and actually be able to reflect the needs of the country there.
Alexander, you're spot on there. The real change for me coming over to PNG was to see where pre-hospital care has its greatest clinical focus, or where the greatest clinical focus of pre-hospital care needs to be. And coming here relatively naive to the resource-limited setting, I originally organized a donation from Stryker of 20, maybe 10 or 12 LifePak 12s and LifePak 20s. And upon arriving, realized that's not where the priority needs to be. And I should have known better. But it has been an interesting adaptation for us. And when we look at our data, the biggest user of ambulance services in Papua New Guinea is immensely different to what is the greatest user of ambulances in Australia. In Papua New Guinea, the largest user of ambulances is females aged between 14 to 30. And the two reasons that they're calling ambulances are primarily obstetric, and secondary is trauma and violence. You look at the curve that we see in ambulance usage, and it's sort of it's a hump in the middle. If you look at age and usage, and you'd go from 0 to 80, and we see a big lump in the middle. And ironically, that's also the reason that we see a big lump in the middle, because there is a big lump in the middle that's caught, you know, with a large percentage of women that are pregnant needing emergency care. Very contrasted to the Australian model, which would generally see an increase in ambulance utilization with age, where the older you are, the greatest user of ambulances tends to be the older population, and the younger you are, the less reliant you are on ambulance. So here, our priorities focus on, three key areas that we can make a big difference in pre-hospital care. The first one being what we're talking about, obstetric. Obstetric was really touched over as a very basic module in all the studies I did in Australia, because it doesn't feature as a primary cause for ambulance utilization. However, when we need to use those skills, we need to be at the top of our game in Australia. The second greatest utilization of ambulances, or where we can make the biggest impact, is respiratory. Respiratory cases here feature quite highly with poor compliance with asthma regimes, or rather the absence of a proper asthma management regime, and that we see a larger number of cases. Another key focus for us is trauma. A trauma, especially knife wounds, gunshot wounds, is a daily occurrence for the ambulance service here. In fact, multiple times a day. We see the full gamut from slash wounds to very serious internal injuries with severe bleeding. And that's just every day here. These are usually into tribal issues that are unfortunately being resolved violently. We also tend to see a high instance of snake bite. Now, it appears on the surface, and I'm talking anecdotally here, that we have a far greater number of snake bites here than we would in Australia. And the contributing factors to that is multifactorial. The first one being that people live closer to gardens and people do gardening here. And so they're more likely to be out in a garden where there's snakes with tall grass. The second one is that people don't wear as much clothing necessarily here. It's hot and they might not have access. So they're in the garden wearing thongs. So when they do come across a snake, it's more likely to result in an actual bite. And thirdly, people are living in a lot less developed environments. There's not concrete and houses that are sort of uninteresting to snakes. It's very much living within the bush environment for a lot of people. We have very high rates of mortality from snake bites here relative to Australia. We see around 1,000 deaths per year from snake bite, as opposed to Australia, who'll see one, two, or maybe three each year, with the population about three times as many people. Snake bite it presents a challenge for us because of the absence of snake bite antivenom at the clinics, and that's not a lack of snake bite antivenom. That is just challenging distribution mechanisms, I would say, politically correct. There are companies paid a fortune to distribute medicines around the country, but that seems to be something that's not happening, and there's various layers of complexity to that. But ultimately, we don't have snake bite antivenom at every health center. And so the ambulance is going to, and we're working presently, my colleague's working presently to set up a system whereby the ambulance will carry snake bite antivenom to be administered by a registered nurse or a physician assistant, which we call a health extension officer here, or a paramedic or a St. John doctor. 24 hours a day, we have a nurse or a physician assistant on an ambulance in the city that goes into some of the rural areas. They'll administer the anti-venom, but we'll also try and have a program where when we go out to that clinic, we'll distribute anti-venom to them as well. We'll bring one for the patient and one for the clinic, and that will be reliant on the clinic having access to cold chain storage, because anti-venom needs to be cold chained. But look, they're the key challenges for us in ambulance.
So having that approach tailored to another country and what they actually need, in order to make all of those changes and those goals sustainable, it's all good and well, I guess, to always have, other services coming in and providing care. But something I heard you say in the past seminar, and you said that, you're trying to have in each local community one person at least who is qualified in first aid. And so that definitely would make it way more sustainable for you guys as well. And then especially with the challenges of distance and terrain and all of that type of difficulty, how important is making something like this sustainable for PNG?
Look, first aid is something that can be taught at various levels. And one of the things we identified early on is that teaching the Australian first aid course here in Papua New Guinea is neither relevant nor meaningful. And the reason for that is the Australian first aid courses are built upon the fact that nearly everyone has access to healthcare and an ambulance service. And it, occasionally when you look at rural, it acknowledges that in rural and remote communities of Australia, they still have access to ambulance services, but obviously not as quick as those in the city. And so the rural folk, have a usually the Royal Flying Doctor Service or the Air Ambulance Service. But someone still comes for them. It might not be as quick as it should be, but they still come. Here in Papua New Guinea, St. John covers around 30% of the population in three provinces. And there's 22 provinces. We're about to open in two more provinces, which will actually expand our reach to around 50 to 60% of the population that lives in road accessible areas. First aid, as we know it in Australia, teaches very much that an ambulance is coming. So we've got ready access to a plethora of first aid consumables, and it also should be really common in the community, an EpiPen. Someone with an allergy will have an EpiPen. It's very uncommon for anyone in Papua New Guinea to be carrying an EpiPen, and we don't really see that as something often. And defibrillators are in the country. They're in many of the hospitals. They're in some of the airports. They're in some of the shopping centres. But it's not common that markets where most of the trade takes place in Papua New Guinea would have a defibrillator at all. In fact, I'm not aware of any market in the country that has a defibrillator. So we thought, why are we teaching the Australian model of first aid here in Papua New Guinea, or the New Zealand or the UK model? It's just not relevant. A lot of the deaths are happening from mothers in labour. They're happening, it's about 5% of women that get pregnant, 1 in 20 will get pregnant and have a high mortality from that. And so the other area we see is wound infection is relatively common, and a lot of that's a contribution for a diet, or perhaps some degree with it being quite a humid environment and people living and doing things more in the outdoor setting than being in sort of a semi-clean house or office as we'd know it. So a combination of factors mean that wound infection is not uncommon for a simple cut. So moving in that direction, we teach two types of first aid courses here. We have major contracts with companies like ExxonMobil, Total, big mining companies here in Papua New Guinea, and they want the Australian standard of first aid. And so that's what we do. And snake bite, for example, being another area of first aid that we teach in the Australian course, presuming that people have access to constrictive or compression roller bandages. That's not common at all. And simply supplying a community with one roller bandage and expecting that to be the panacea to their snake bite problems is very naive. So in actual fact, we've redeveloped a course. We've based it loosely on the principles of the Australasian Wilderness Life Support program. We've based it on where there's been evidence, clinical evidence. So, for example, our first aid in communities program, which we teach as a first aid in schools program to year nine students, that currently has a focus on, how to assist with a normal birth, how to identify when something goes wrong. With snake bites, we're focusing very much on keeping the limb still, which ironically seems to be where the evidence lies. And the evidence is emerging that perhaps compression bandages may be at the golden solution that we once thought they were. So we're focusing on keeping the patient still. And we're also focusing on wound care, being that people probably don't have access to a 30 mil ampules of sterilized saline and non-adherent dressings coupled with a size 5 roller bandage and gauze. So we're focusing on what do people have access to. Well, everyone's got water, everyone has fire, and so you can boil water to give it somewhat of some sterileness, and you can add salt to that. You can let it cool and you can wash the wound. Nearly everyone in PNG has a banana tree in the backyard, so we're talking about using a banana leaf once cleaned and perhaps boiled and then cooled, it can be an effective wound covering to minimize the bacteria entering the wound. And we're encouraging that twice daily for wounds. These sort of skills are evidence-based. There's a lot of traditional medicine that perhaps doesn't have a strong evidence basis for it, whether that's putting various forms of tree sap or something on the wound. We're sticking purely to the evidence, and the evidence suggests that, for simple, straightforward wounds, maybe a bush knife cut to your arm, cleaning it twice daily and covering the wound should be more than adequate to reduce the chance of infection. Our ambulance officers, they do a 6-month course, and obviously they've got access to sterile saline and gauze, so we're not going around in ambulances putting banana leaves on wound. But for people that are in remote areas, that's what we're teaching.
Well, that sounds a bit like you're working really well with them, and I guess that makes it a bit more, I wouldn't say compliant, but like more readily able to take on that information. And I guess if you're utilizing things that they use on a daily basis and that's actually accessible to them, then that would actually make a difference.
Yeah, look, and I think so. And as we said, when we developed this course, there had to be either a strong evidence base or a well-accepted practice in the industry. This is a St. John course, so there's an expectation that what we are recommending, by virtue of St. John being a global health leader in pre-hospital care, that it needs to have a strong evidence basis to it. And that's what we've done. And this is this course is a course that we teach here in PNG, and we've made all the materials for the course available online. So if anyone else wants to take up this course, then it's there and available. And the way we developed this course was with a senior paramedic from St. John, Western Australia, that was over here under an Australian government volunteers program. And we only achieved the development of the course and the cartoons and the materials to go with it through partnership with one of the leading benevolent foundations here in Papua New Guinea called the Sir Brian Bell Foundation. Sir Brian Bell's a bit like Coles Myer Group, I guess. They are sort of a rebel sport with a Bunnings warehouse with a Kmart. So they're a gigantic company that's been operating in the country for 64 years, or thereabouts, 60 years. And when the gentleman that set it up, Sir Brian, passed away from old age, he left a large foundation that primarily partnered with St. John and some other great organisations to just empower us to make a contribution in the community.
That's really cool. And you were saying before that you had obviously a senior paramedic come over from Western Australia on sort of a volunteer type of role. Are there opportunities for paramedics in Australia or anywhere to come over and do a voluntary sort of stint?
Yeah, over the last 5 years, we've had a huge number from the well-known people like Alan Morrison, Joe Cuthbertson, and Joe's come over with Ozmat, but Alan Morrison and Phil Proust, a few others that you know, Kieran Ratt from Victoria, and Sean Whitmore from one of the Mica helicopter flight paramedics in Victoria. So these are all names that I think all the students would or should have heard of. And look, a lot of those guys have come over in various capacities over the last few years to contribute to, I guess, expanding the profession in the Pacific. And I think there is possibly even a greater need for emergency ambulance services in the traditional model in the Pacific than really other places that you can imagine. There's a great need for pre-hospital care, and there's a great need for paramedicine. And I think as the new and upcoming leadership of our profession, we need to be helping to expand it, not just focusing on our own backyard where we've got things pretty well sorted in Australia. We have excellent pre-hospital care education programs. We have excellent pre-hospital care delivery. But the Pacific doesn't yet, and there's plenty of opportunities in Papua New Guinea and Fiji. There is emerging opportunities in Fiji and the Solomon Islands. There's emerging opportunities, but really the two common places that paramedics are going to support is to see Papua New Guinea with St. John and Pro Medical in Vanuatu. Both are great organisations, and I'm obviously biased about one, and the other one with many of the team there. We hosted them here in Papua New Guinea. We hosted Vanuatu Pro Medical here in Papua New Guinea last year for our pre-hospital care conference for the Pacific. And certainly, you know, there is a huge opportunity.
Definitely. And what, I guess, are some of the qualities that are strengthened by working in a challenging environment? So, for example, like your problem-solving skills, leadership, communication, all of that type of stuff. So what can people who are wanting to volunteer or thinking about it after they finish the degree or if they're graduates, what can they gain in terms of skill-wise from doing a volunteer stint over in PNG?
Look, I think the first skill that they will gain will be working with different cultures. People over in the Pacific are very used to the Australian culture. They've grown up watching Australian TV at home. But there are some differences in the way that people conduct business. They're not major differences, but there are differences. And learning and how to work with people and do business in a different culture is an important life school. And wherever you go around the world, there are different ways of doing business, from the streets of from the Wall Street in New York to the London Stock Exchange. I'm sure there's differences in the way the business is conducted, and just like there is between how we do ambulance services in Sydney to how we treat patients in Sydney to how we treat patients in Papua New Guinea. There are differences, and working with different teams, there's different team dynamics, and those things are opportunities that should be embraced, because our way of doing things isn't always right. And I think something I've learned working over here is a real appreciation for the fact that the way I did things isn't always the most effective. And I've learned a lot from my counterparts here in Papua New Guinea, the 6 years I've been here, and had a real appreciationship. One of the biggest lessons I've learned is a real appreciationship for the importance of relationships in how we do business and how we work as teams. That investment in a relationship, be it professional or be it personal, is just so important, especially in Pacific Island nations. The opportunity for paramedics isn't just clinical. Don't expect that if you come to Papua New Guinea that every second job is going to be a big one of the big ones that you're expecting. They're not, and we get our fair share of challenging work, certainly. And you can hear my phone going off in the background. Our CAD system will update if there's any major emergencies, and there's one taking place now. But for paramedics, it's not just going to be clinical. You're going to need to come over with an open mind to be ready to contribute in ways beyond clinical practice. You can leave a legacy by having a relaxed approach to your training and making training very, very practical, and really minimizing theory as much as possible to the absolute essentials, keeping things practical, keeping it protocolized at this point. This is a young profession that's developing here, and when we started paramedics in the 70s, we weren't giving them an option between, you know, a range of 10 micrograms of fentanyl to 50 micrograms of fentanyl in an IV dose. We were saying you give X amount of morphine or however the case may be. It's a much more protocolized regime, and that's important to embrace as a new profession, that there needs to be some quantitative, some absolute direction with very little room for error. And I think the profession will naturally evolve to be able to work with guidelines rather than protocols. But also some other areas that we see contribution is in systems development, you know, putting in place a system for retraining, you know, every year. That's an area of focus for us this year. We've developed training programs for over here, and now we need to work out how do we make sure our staff are retrained and taught again, and also being able to come over and help adapt protocols and review protocols and guidelines. So, but those are some of my things. But you asked me about skills, so I think skills is adaptability, patience. And these are more attributes than anything. The attributes you need to be coming over to PNG is patience and having an adapt. Their word is improvise, modify, adapt, and overcome all the challenges you face.
Can graduates who have just finished the degree and they're waiting on a job for, say, if they don't hear back for 6 to 12 months, do they need to have clinical experience before coming in volunteering, or can they come over with the degree as a graduate?
I'm a big fan of the concept of having graduates work in these settings. I think it depends on the individual graduate and their exposure and their experience working as professionals. A young graduate with no previous, that hasn't worked anywhere before, gone straight from school and, you know, finished the degree, you might need to get some life experience before you come over. But as a graduate that's perhaps been involved in other things, maybe producing a podcast or working at Woolworths, working or volunteering for St John Ambulance,
those are very important skills that I think will give you important life skills that will prepare you for coming over and working in a place like this. I think the second part is perhaps expectations. Our expectations, if we were to employ a graduate, would not be that you would work as a fully qualified paramedic. We'd put in place, you'd be perhaps in an intermediate life support skill set without IV cannulation, and perhaps focusing on the really important basics, because that's also what saves lives in these settings. And we'd want to make sure that if you're coming over as a graduate, that there's a support mechanism for you in place. And what's made us hesitant with graduates in the past isn't necessarily how capable they are, but our own concern that we don't have the support mechanisms in place for a new graduate. But as we're getting stronger and stronger and our team's getting more experienced, we're starting to open up to the possibility of graduates coming to work here for a year to get that experience, but not necessarily clinical. We're talking about life skills and life experience, and those are invaluable skills that will prepare you, if not make you a far better paramedic when you go to a home service back in Australia or New Zealand. But most importantly, having graduates over here, we said that they'll operate to an intermediate life support level, at least initially. There needs to be a support mechanism for them, both professionally and personally. And then finally, we would prefer that the graduates come over here to work on a specific project with an outcome at the end. And that might be helping to do a review on our training programs, or helping to do a review on a set number of protocols, but also working to train up our basic life support level officers. So from that, you might not gain the, I would dare to say that you would not be able to say that this was your 1 year of supervised clinical practice, because it won't be, but it'll be your one year as a 1 year that you've been able to contribute to a system, work at an intermediate life support level, say an EMT level, gain invaluable life experience. And ultimately that will make you far more competitive when it comes to recruitment than your peers who perhaps may have taken a year off and travelled or something else. This will make you very competitive. And if you contribute, St John is a member of the CAA, the Council of Ambulance Authorities, so we're a recognised service in that respect. Having spent a year working for us will no doubt look good when you apply to other CAA ambulance services.
That's really great, because one of the main questions we get a lot of the time is, you know, what can I do whilst I'm waiting for that job? And I guess, yes, it might not necessarily be your grad intern program and not count towards that, but that's, you know, this is an opportunity, I guess, instead of just reading a textbook or, you know, just, you know, waiting around for 8 months. It's just a really great way to do something with your time, with your degree, and network and meet new people and contribute something to another community. So I think that's really, really great. So I guess I'm very conscious of your time, because I know you're an incredibly busy man. But we'll go through our last three questions. And our last three questions are ones that we ask every single guest that we have on. So that our students that are listening and our graduates, they can get the opportunity to hear all different answers to those same questions. So the first one is, what mistake has resulted in your greatest learning?
I think the attitude when I first started as a paramedic into my home service, perhaps was a Dunning-Kruger effect. I felt I knew everything and had nothing to learn from my training officers. That's probably a very over-exaggerated version of my view, but sort of felt that I was overconfident, and perhaps my confidence level was a very good trainee ambulance paramedic, and that's about it. I think that was a vital lesson to me, because it showed me that as a student, you have to understand that there's expectations that you contribute to the team, but you also respect those that have come before you and that have more experience than you. And I think that's something that you can apply as a life skill across the board, that, you know, you still have a voice as a member of the team, and you still must speak up as a member of the team. But you can do that in a way that's respectful. And never always be aware of the Dunning-Kruger effect, and assess where you sit on that scale. Because I think some of us, including myself, have been in situations where our confidence was greater than our competence. That's probably would be my tip.
That's a great tip. And, well, I guess I don't know if that answers our next one, but our next one is, what is one piece of advice that you would give to a student?
I think students can be very, it can be a very difficult to give advice to a student, because your training officers can be all different sorts of people. And I think getting to understand the personality of a training officer, but asking them questions initially. Don't be disheartened if you get someone if you're on a placement and your training officer says, oh, you're here to observe. Their issue isn't with you. Their issue is with them. A thousand other things. You know, if you walk in on day one and you've got a fantastic training officer that's passionate, then good on you, you scored well. But sometimes you're going to get training officers that through no fault of your own aren't going to be the biggest fans of having students or having to work with other people. And they're not bad people, those ones. They've probably got other things going on in their world that's complicating yours at that very time that you're on placement. So I think ask your training officer what they expect from you, and ask your training officer what you can do to be a better student, and then continue to ask questions, and don't give up on those question askings if you don't like the answers. It's just part of being a professional that sometimes you have to work with people that you love, and other times you have to work with people that you find challenging, and just persevere as best you can, and have some mechanisms, be it amongst your group, that you can debrief in pride and in confidence about your day out on road. And you'll need to do exactly the same when you become a paramedic on road as well. You'll work with people that you absolutely love, and then you'll work with people that, you know, just are not having a great week or great month. They're still good people, but they're just not having the best week. And you, unfortunately, spend every minute of your working day with those people. It can bring you down or it can lift you up.
That's really great advice. So the last one is, what did you used to believe to be true that you no longer believe to be true?
That oxygen helps in myocardial infarction in patients that have normal oxygen level. I think that's definitely something that I was adamant was the right treatment. Your patient's having a heart attack, put them on 15 litres non-rebreather. Maybe I'm talking to you guys and you're wondering what I'm talking about, but certainly 12 years ago, it was well believed that the patient that was having a heart attack needed high flow, non-rebreather oxygen, and that's because the heart wasn't getting enough oxygen to the myocardium distal to the blockage. But that was something that I certainly believed to be true, it's an important lesson that I use for all our staff that are having difficulty adapting their practice. I think we used to think that iodine was particularly important to wound healing. That's gone out of fashion. We used to think that the mask suit was particularly important. That's definitely gone out of fashion. But recently we've introduced something that seems like it's a mask suit, but it's not. But it's actually saving lives, as the research is showing, and that's called the non-pneumatic anti-shock garment, or NASG, NASG, and that's being rolled out across the world in resource-challenged environments on ambulances to save mothers in labour that have postpartum hemorrhage. And this device is like a wetsuit that squeezes the blood from, you put it on the feet first, then the calf muscles, then the thigh muscles, and then around the waist. And thinking, oh, this sounds like a mask suit. And as you realize, the next step is around the waist of the mother or around the belly. There's actually a large device, and your listeners can look it up, that compresses, or that as you stretch the material around the back to the front, and I'm not describing it very well, but essentially it's got a ball in it that places pressure on the uterus to contract the uterus and reduce bleeding. It's not the panacea solution, but it is a temporary fix to the problem of postpartum hemorrhage, one of the causes of postpartum hemorrhage. So I think embracing the fact that our profession is very new and the medical profession is a lot more mature than paramedicine. And even they're finding that practices that doctors have done for decades or maybe even centuries isn't always going to last. And we have to embrace that changes happen to our profession. And I've actually still got, I've been given a copy from the St. John Historian of the one of the first aid manuals from, I'm going to say around 1887.
Wow, that would black be and completely white, different. Drawings.
Yeah, and look, there's some interesting things in it. It still talks about blood being pumped out, you know, through the arteries and returning back to the heart through the venous system. Interestingly, that appears to remain accurate, but certainly the technique of doing CPR with the patient prone and pushing on their lower back has fortunately adapted over the years. So I think embrace change and always ask questions to challenge ideas, because the profession will only grow when each of us takes responsibility for it.
That's great. And I was only laughing before at the oxygen, because we just get drilled. That gets drilled into us in nursing. So so when you said that, I was like, oh,
yeah.
It feels like I'm back in my nursing tutorials.
Are they still saying use oxygen in AMI?
No, they're saying don't. Like, we get drilled that into us now. Like, don't do it.
Yeah. But I started nursing, studying nursing, 12 years ago, and it was the opposite. We were being encouraged to give high flow. So in just a short amount of time, the practice has changed from, you know, it's almost binary. It was yes, and now it's not. So, very, very interesting, but do embrace that change.
Definitely.
And ask questions and keep our profession growing.
I love that. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to have a chat to us today. I'll wrap it up there. Where can our listeners find out more about St. John Ambulance Service over in Papua New Guinea and about you?
The greatest way to find out what we're doing in Papua New Guinea is Facebook. We keep our page pretty updated. If you just search on Facebook, SJAPNG, St. John Ambulance Papua New Guinea, that will come up. Listeners are also welcome to if they want to find out about me. My Facebook page is open, so most welcome to look through and see. I try to keep updated and use it as a work tool to keep updated. The power of social media in PNG is immense, and is a much more commonly used tool for people to communicate than what I'm used to in Australia. Facebook is probably the best way to stay. We've got a website, but Facebook's usually updated earlier. So,
thank you for listening, guys. You can find us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and you can email us at the studentparamedicpodcast@gmail.com. So we'll catch you in the next one. Thank you.